With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
If you enjoy the podcasts that we do here at Motorsport Magazine, let me tell you about our new sound archive. If you go to motorsportmagazine.com, you can find our new sound archive, and within that, you will find my Track Talk radio programs that I recorded on Radio Victory between 1977 and 1981. And once a month, we'll be releasing one of those Track Talk programs. And the next one, the very latest one, will take us back to the summer of 1977 when we go to the British Grand Prix at Silverstone and to the 24 hours of Le Mans. So tune in to Track Talk. Hear it all again. Maybe you heard it the first time round. If not, it's an absolute must. And you'll find it at shop.motorsportmagazine.com. That's shop, S-H-O-P, .motorsportmagazine.com. Right, now it's time to tell you about our Formula One season review for 2015. And it's available now from motorsportmagazine.com. This costs just $7.99, an absolute bargain for a review of the entire 2015 Grand Prix racing season. You can get it at shop.motorsportmagazine.com. And our editor, Damien Smith, says in the introduction that nobody understands Formula One better than motorsport, as both an arena for sporting and technical excellence. And just as significantly, as far as we're concerned, from the perspective of what Grand Prix racing has meant to its millions of fans during the course of the past century. These reports are the result of 19 all-nighters composed in the seclusion of modest hotel rooms in the hours of darkness after each Grand Prix, from knowledge freshly trawled in frenetic Formula One paddocks. There are over 90,000 words. So don't miss the Motorsport Magazine Formula One season review for 2015. All the news, all the features, all the investigations from our man Mark Hughes at every single Grand Prix. Just $7.99 from shop.motorsportmagazine.com. Welcome, everybody, to another Motorsport Magazine podcast. And this is our last one of the year, just a few days before Christmas. And I hope you'll agree that we've saved the best till last, because so many people have been on the website saying, why can't you get Pat Simmons back? Well, there are various reasons, like lots of Grand Prix and being in foreign countries all the time and trying to beat Mercedes-Benz and lots of other little things he has to do. But anyway, he's here. Pat Simmons is here, and we're in the Ram pub in Chelsea. We thought it would be nice to come to the Ram because it's Christmas time, and we used to have our office around the corner, but not anymore. Anyway, welcome, Pat.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be here.
Good, good. Now, look, we don't want to talk forever and ever about Mercedes-Benz and Hamilton and Rosberg, because that's all everybody ever talks about, and it all gets a bit... Ugh. But I want to ask you, why can't anyone beat Mercedes-Benz, and what are you going to do about it?
Well, I could probably give you around 250 million answers, each one costing a pound, and that might give you a clue.
I see. Right. Okay. Well, that's a good short answer and a good explanation, I guess. But is that real? Are you saying to me that if I did give you £250 million, you could beat Mercedes-Benz?
No, to be honest, that's a slightly light-hearted comment. But there is, as always, some truth behind it in that, you know, Formula One has got to a point now with these enormous budgets and very restrictive rules where performance tends to come from attention to detail, and attention to detail in many different areas. Now, attention to detail is quite an expensive thing because you need people involved in it. You need, if you want to pay attention to a lot of different areas, you need a lot of people. And I think if you look at Mercedes-Benz company accounts, which were published just 6 weeks or so ago, you look at the number of people they've got, you look at the average salary, you know, they've got some pretty clever people there working very hard. And they're working on these little details that, you know, at Williams, we have to be very, very attentive to our where we're going to put our effort in. You know, we have to cherry pick. We can't just sort of blanket hit everything and sort of accept that certain things aren't going to be fruitful. We just have to, we have to work, I guess, a lot smarter than they do. Now, I'm not taking anything away from them. They're a fabulous team, and you know, this level of domination is impressive, even if it's not terribly exciting for the fans. But yeah, good luck to them, and we'll just have to try a bit harder.
Is it more of a challenge than it was at Renault for you now? I mean, because you haven't got a huge budget, you haven't got a huge number of people, so it's a bigger challenge, yes or no?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, 2005, 2006, when we won the championships at Renault, we had about 500 people. We had budgets that were larger then than they are now at Williams. And, of course, we weren't paying for engines. Yeah. So, I think, yeah, we were well funded. We did have a lot of people. We had a fabulous team spirit, all those sort of things, you know. But yes, I think the answer is it was a bit easier then than it is now.
Mark, have you got any more questions for Pat? You've obviously been talking to him for the last 9 months, but anyway.
Well, yeah, since we last spoke, since the last Grand Prix, that we've had confirmation that Renault's re-entering and has bought the Enstone team, where you've spent about, I don't know, 80-90% of your working life. What do you think the prospects are in the immediate term and in the long term for that team?
The first thing I'd say is I'm just so pleased that that Enstone is surviving. You know, a large part of my heart's in that team, no matter what name's above the door. There's some great people there, a lot of them that I've worked with. Really pleased to see it be carrying on, and whether it's a Renault name or whatever, I don't think that matters too much. They've got a lot of work to do now. Enstone's a great facility. We built it in the 80s, I guess. I can't even remember myself. Seems a long while ago, but it I think it was late 80s. Put the wind tunnel in at the sort of just going into the 90s. A lot of good stuff there. A lot of good people, and now I think a decent budget, because I think Renault are talking about a €200 million budget. Now that's pretty damn good. You can go racing with that. But they've got to rebuild, because unfortunately over the last few years, for financial reasons, the owners at Enstone have let a lot of good people go. I don't think, other than the simulator, I can't imagine there's been much capital investment there. You know, they've got a bit of rebuilding to do. First of all, getting people in. And, you know, so difficult in Formula One getting employees, because everyone's on these long-term contracts and you have to find the window to get them in. So They've got 2-3 years, I think, of rebuilding. And that's apart from, of course, wherever the power unit might be in the coming years.
What was remarkable for a while, even after Renault pulled out, was how many layers of expertise that team seemed to have, and they would still come up with a quick comment. You left, Bob Bell left, and then you thought, well, that's probably going to spiral downwards now. And then James Allison came up, and he sort of led a good series of cars, and then he left, and it was still stayed respectable for a while. Do you think it's now got to the stage where there's too many layers have been peeled away for immediate success?
No, I think there's still some good people there. Now, yes, you're quite right. You know, I guess the sort of last big technical lead was James. Looking at what he's doing at Ferrari, I mean, those of us who know him and have worked with him, there's no surprise in that. He's a very clever guy. He's a very intellectual guy. So he's not just he's not just someone who knows how to make a racing car go fast. He's got vision and intelligence. I think that. I guess Bob's back there at Enstone, so he can sort of pick up where he left off, and I'm sure he'll start knocking it into shape pretty quickly.
The good strong season for Williams Mercedes this year, third in the Constructors' Championship. I've not been to so many races this year, but from the outside looking in, is Felipe Massa overperforming and Valtteri Bottas underperforming? Or, I mean, I don't expect you to sort of slag off one or the other of your drivers, but the general perception is that Valtteri is a champion for the future, but Felipe is quite often, you know, you'd expect perhaps that Valtteri should give him a damn good kicking, but he hasn't. Now, is that Felipe upping his game, Valtteri not quite performing, or where do you see it?
I think it's Felipe upping his game. I think when we signed Felipe, really not long after I'd got to Williams, at the end of 13, ready for the 14 season, I was very pleased that we'd signed him. I thought he was an excellent fit for the team in every way, you know, that sort of respectability, that rebranding that we were trying to do with the whole team. And my only fear was how he would react when Valtteri beat him, because, you know, I really had seen a little bit of Valtteri. I thought the guy was really, really good. I still think he's really, really good, but I guess my surprise is that in reality, Felipe's a lot better than I thought. And, you know, that just shows how transient we all are, aren't we? Because in 2008, you know, he was, well, arguably he was world champion for 5 seconds, yeah, or however you want to look at it. You know, he was a strong contender all the way through that.
Well, if he'd won it that year, it would have been completely on merit. You couldn't take it absolutely.
Yes,
on merit.
Absolutely, and I think we'd all forgotten that because since the accident in Hungary, you know, arguably, although in retrospect I think it's coincidental, but arguably, you know, his performance had dropped a little bit, and what it needed was that sort of reinvigorating that I think he got from leaving Ferrari, coming to Williams, being in a team that really respected him, really liked him, really wanted him to get on. And we saw that he was also pretty damn quick if you gave him the right conditions.
Nigel?
Just coming back to budgets, Pat, something that struck me towards the end of the year was the whole business with Felipe and the, quote, overheated tyres, the controversy about all that. And the fact that, correct me if I'm getting this wrong, Williams believed they were absolutely bang to rights, in the right, not a problem, but on purely financial grounds decided not to challenge it. And on top of that, if you got your points back, you know, that would also have bunged another God knows what on top of your
about 15
championship
grand,
entry fee for next year.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
I won't say it was totally
a sad situation, I thought.
It is, but it wasn't totally on financial grounds. I mean, you have to understand that the International Court of Appeal is populated by some pretty good legal brains, and you can't go in there living on your wits. And, you know, I've been there a few times. I've even won a case there, which, you know, I think only myself and Ross have ever done.
Yeah.
So you have to be prepared to go in there with pretty high power QC, is a very good case. It takes a lot of preparation, takes a lot of effort.
And a lot of money.
And a lot of money. And we didn't feel it was particularly a good use of money. I think if it happened at the beginning of the year, when we wouldn't have known whether the points were important or not, we'd have had to go for it. But you know, at the end of the year, we knew third place was secured. We didn't need to do any more. And it was just a pragmatic solution. I felt a little bit aggrieved because by withdrawing that appeal, I'm sure some people thought, oh, well, you know, maybe they were in the wrong. But I think in Abu Dhabi, I demonstrated to a number of the press, I think you were there, Mark, how we believed, you know, a very genuine mistake had been made in the measurement. And how it could occur. So I felt we vindicated our position without spending time or money on a perhaps a bit of a wild goose chase.
Pat, before we get into some more general stuff from our amazingly loyal listeners and readers, Ron Dennis has said that he doesn't think anyone's ever going to beat a works team with the way that Formula One is structured at the moment, with the Ferrari and Mercedes being so powerful. If that's
true, you could probably beat McLaren. You could probably beat McLaren.
Yes,
that's a works team.
Well, certainly.
Yeah, I think what he said was with the customer engine, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And of course,
thank you, Mark.
He said it in Rom speak. What I remind him, perhaps, is that in 2009, he had the works Mercedes engine, and he was beaten by a customer engine. So, not sure it's true.
So he may have forgotten.
I think he forgot that. Yeah.
But I mean, I suppose the wider point is maybe Mark has a Mark does have a view on this. Is that our Ferrari is the might of Ferrari and Mercedes threatening to seriously undermine what we all, you know, the sport business we all love? I mean, from the outside, it does appear so slightly.
Well, if I would answer that, I'd say since the hybrid era has come to be and the investment made by the engine manufacturers, it has become that's become a differentiator in the frozen spec V8 era. Yeah. It hadn't, and it was purely down to teams and their aerodynamics and etc. So it's now more multifaceted, and to combat that is those cycles are more complex and take longer to go around. So I would say Mercedes and Ferrari last year were the only two that had competitive engines, and sure. So hopefully we can get two more competitive engines in it for next year or going forward from there. It might start to look a bit more competitive again, but I think the mistake made with the regulations in the hybrid era was not putting a price that they had to be available to, and not stipulating that they had to supply whoever was needing one.
You agree with that, Pat?
Yeah, I think so. Is it new though? We've got to remember the early 2000s when Ferrari dominated in normally aspirated era. We can go back to McLaren Honda's winning 15 or 16
Lotus,
races. I think it is the way of things, and we have short memories. at the moment, Ferrari, or during 2015, Ferrari have challenged Mercedes, winning the second race. You know, that
sure
surprised everyone, didn't it?
Yeah.
Williams and Red Bull have been able over the last 2 years to snap at their heels.
Yep.
It's not the end of the world yet.
No, it's for sure not the end of the world, no. But can we have a little talk about the 2017 regulations? Is this the right way to be going, Pat? Surely not.
Do you know where it's going?
Well, I don't know the precise technicalities of it, but I know that the idea is to make the cars a lot faster.
With a bigger front wing.
Sorry?
With a big front wing.
Maybe a bit louder. That's probably, that would be quite a nice thing.
Yeah, but overwhelmingly, they're talking about more downforce.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose my question is this going to make Formula One better or worse, more exciting or not?
Yeah, the thing with a podcast as opposed to your monthly magazine is we can get right up to date.
Oh, good, because clearly I'm not.
Today, there's a TRM going on, technical regulation meeting.
Right.
So I parked my car around the corner, and as I walked to meet you, I took my messages from our chief designer who's attending that meeting, and it's totally different to what it was yesterday. There's a
well, do tell.
So we can be quite up to date with these things. So the mood of the meeting today is that Pirelli have said that with the sort of loads that the cars will be capable of producing if we stick to the aerodynamic rules that the strategy group have asked us to develop, that their tyres won't be able to handle it unless they make them much, let's say, more resilient, and therefore slower, and therefore negating a lot of what was done. So now there's a bit of a backtrack today to try and pull some downforce off the cars. So I think...
What's all this?
I really think Alice in Wonderland ought to be sitting on the strategy group.
It was just something Pat said that we better not pick up on. And
what?
The fact that, yeah, we try and make the cars fast aerodynamically, and then the tyre manufacturers said, well, we can't do that, and so we'll have to make harder tyres, therefore.
Which will dial out a second lap of whatever that we've just got through downforce. Fantastic.
This is when you call Michelin, isn't it?
But isn't the fact that we're all laughing about it, doesn't that tell us, hang on, we may have a new regulation?
More downforce.
We thought we had a new regulation coming through there. But the fact that we're all sort of laughing, oblique sniggering about it, does tell you something, doesn't it? I mean, you know, that it's all too complicated. Doesn't it need simplifying some of this, Pat?
I'm not convinced it's complicated. What do we mean by complicated? What we've got to do is we've got to make sure that for the spectator, for the fan, things are simple.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter the levels of complexity below that the engineers and the teams have to deal with. I don't think matters a lot. It comes down to a cost thing, of course. You know, that does come
but
into
it. The spectacle
it.
Does matter.
But the important thing is that we have something nice and simple that the spectators can understand. I think it needs to be a reasonably genuine competition, and I add the word reasonably because I think, unfortunately, if you make it a pure competition, you will get the dominance that can damage the sport. And so, although I know Nigel is hates DRS with a huge intensity, those sort of things I think actually can improve the racing and. Yeah, we've had some very dull racing without overtaking.
Well, but it would also improve the racing. They simply made the cars to a specification where they're allowed to overtake, where they could overtake without DRS.
Yeah, I think I do agree with that. And it's why, to be honest, the 2017 regulations as they stood, I don't think were very strategic. The trouble is that we get this sort of decree. It's a bit of a unilateral decree that what we need to do is make the cars faster and then everything will be fine, and we have to go and do it. And I cannot understand where the logic comes from that puts us there, because suddenly someone, and I think it's just one person, decides that if we make the cars 5 seconds a lap quicker, everything will be fixed, everything will be great.
No, it won't.
But we actually
run faster.
Yeah, we run between, yeah, when we do our sort of low fuel runs at the beginning of P2 on Friday, between our, and then going into our high fuel runs, yeah, we got a difference 4 or 5 seconds. Can any of you, if I blindfolded you and pushed you out by the side of the track without you knowing whether it was the beginning of P2 or the end of P2, you wouldn't have a clue which it was. 5 seconds a lap is meaningless. It's absolutely nothing to do with it. And this idea that, I think one of the things that led to it was Max Verstappen. And this sort of thought that how can someone who's 17 years old come and drive a Formula One car? Well, why the hell can't he?
Yeah.
I'd look the other way and say, why have we got people in their late 30s driving Formula One cars? You know, they should be gone by then. It should be a young person's sport. What's the age of a professional footballer? You know, it goes into his 30s and he stops. And a lot of them starting as teenagers.
If you'd said that in 1950, Fangio would never have had a career. And he was in his late 30s when he arrived.
Yeah, but I don't think that destroys my argument at all. We've got to appeal to the kids amongst all the other things. And I mean, someone who's driving racing cars while they're in their late 30s, the kids think that they're grandfathers, you know. They want to
say,
it's
not only the kids who matter.
It's not only the kids who matter, but I tell you what, when we're long dead and gone, those kids do matter because they are the ones who replace us.
What also matters is that whatever your view of Verstappen is, he's very exciting to watch, and that does matter because it should be very exciting to watch.
I agree, and I think that's one of the advantages of youth, isn't it? That you're a little bit impetuous, and that's a good thing when it comes to sporting endeavour.
I just wanted to throw this in quickly. Last time you were here on the Motorsport Magazine podcast, Pat, you said that Williams wasn't ready for Fernando Alonso. So, are you now?
What you said was not next year. A year after. Maybe.
I know that. Mark knows me very well, and he knows how much I do my homework. So, driving down here today, I listened to your season preview podcast so that I'd know what you were going to talk about. And of course, that was one of the things that came up. I did say that. I would still say that, but now I would add that McLaren aren't ready for Fernando Alonso either.
Well, not yet. Now, you.
Which is what I said about Williams.
Okay. Are we getting some new regs through on the phone?
I'm just teeing something up that I found quite amusing the other day.
I'll
share with you later on.
Okay. Let's talk very briefly about McLaren Honda because it's one of the stories of the year, obviously. Mark, you were quite pessimistic actually mid-year about them. How are you feeling now? And also, can I ask you, Mark, isn't it bonkers that the regulations prevent them improving the engine enough to get to the front of the grid? Then we'd all have a better race and we'd all see two world champions at the front, not trailing around with the manners. And
I don't think they are prevented by the regulations as they were implemented last year. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Pat, they will be implemented this year as well, whereby you can have development during the season.
But then don't you get penalties?
The penalties are for something else.
But this shows that it's too damn complicated.
Absolutely,
might be that, or it might show that I'm completely off the case. But anyway, I thought that
when you referred to me being pessimistic earlier in this year, it was when the regulations were about to revert to the original with 2014, whereby nothing could be done during the season. And at that stage, the word from the Honda engineers to the McLaren engineers was, we're not going to get this new engine ready in time for the February 28th deadline, in which case they were going to have an awful 2016, just as bad as 15. Now, as they are about to be interpreted, I don't think that limitation is no longer there. You're not allowed to develop in season. You still have the penalty system, but it doesn't freeze your engine for the season. There's an ever sort of tightening noose around your neck as the years go by, but there's plenty of scope for development still before that becomes a limitation.
But Pat, what I don't understand here, forgive me, is I don't get why these regulations exist, because surely part of motor racing is to develop your car and make it...
It was for reasons of cost.
So
But the cost is out of control anyway, isn't it?
No, but that's not, you know, that's not an excuse for making it worse.
Well, that's the most ridiculous argument I've heard.
Yes, I know. Well, no. Well, yes, but
we have a murder rate in London. Then, it's got really bad. So let's forget about making it illegal.
Okay. Well, we'll have to edit out. we'll have to edit out my worst stupidity. But listen. But the thing is, what I meant was that as a percentage of the whole cost, it makes a real difference to prevent people from developing, does it?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yes, it does. And you know, you can't isolate the power unit and say, well, because Renault and Honda haven't made a decent power unit, let's allow them to catch up. Right. Yeah. My car doesn't have as much downforce as a Mercedes, so why don't you give me more wind tunnel time? You know, it's exactly the same argument. You cannot be selective because someone's cocked up.
Okay, so what you're saying is
in the past there have been times when, if memory serves, when Renault were allowed to catch up, weren't they? In the
on
Red
the power
Bull.
Unit. Yeah. The yes. Yeah, there was. Yeah.
So there are anomalies along the way.
Yeah.
But why doesn't someone who's less stupid come up with a question now? I'm going to take a little break, okay? And because I think maybe I'm more Formula Ford than I am.
Pat, you were saying that the 2016 Williams is going to be a different concept from the last two cars. First of all, is that the case? And is there a limitation with the 37 that you couldn't surpass?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite hard to answer these questions with you know what you consider evolutionary, what you consider revolutionary. I don't think when you see the car, you'll go, "Crikey, you know, that looks unlike anything I've ever seen before." But in our world, yeah, we've made some reasonably significant changes. I have to say some of the more revolutionary things that we tried during the development of this car haven't worked, and we've had to revert to something a little bit more conventional. But at the same time, you know, in the world of a designer, yes, it's quite a different car, but I'm afraid it's not one where you're going to look at it and say, that doesn't look like anything I've ever seen before.
Pat, can I just ask, you were talking earlier about keeping things simple for the spectators and keeping them entertained. Do you think they've had a fair deal in 2015? And I ask that because when I was working in the paddock full time, even a race that was on the surface, not necessarily particularly close fought, I'd go through the race history chart and I'd look at various strategies and I'd always find a point of interest, to me, certainly. Now, this year, even though I'm at a distance most of the time, I still look at race history charts out of interest, and I have struggled quite often this year to find, you know, any points of interest. I just wondered, how it looked to you from the pit wall.
I think I agree with you. I think 14 was actually a really good year,
because
even though we had that domination of the Mercedes, there was some damn good racing between the Mercedes. There was, you know, three wins for Red Bull. There was, Williams getting there and things like that. There were lots of points of interest. Now, this year, okay, we've had the wins for Ferrari as well, but we haven't had that fight with the Mercedes. You know, we've had this thing that absolutely bewilders me, where Lewis sort of dominates until he wins the championship, and then...
Then he crashes his road car in Monaco and falls asleep.
Nico sort of wakes up after that. And that, you know, I think we all think we understand a lot about motorsport. When we see things like that, I wonder whether we really do. You know, who can explain that?
Well, I think that's this bit I find really interesting, because it's about the people, not the cars. And doesn't it just show you that even guys at that level, I mean, they're just human beings, and Lewis, you know, job done, exhausted, got everything he wanted, ticked everything off on the stat sheet, and that's a few tenths, isn't it? Don't you think? And all
Pat,
it needed.
Pat, could you imagine Vettel or Alonso being like that?
Well, yes, I can, because I don't think that I actually think you're quite right. I think that is what's happened. But I would guarantee that Lewis would, he'd be appalled at that suggestion because he really would not believe it. No. And I think it's something that happens in your subconscious.
Yeah,
we were talking earlier about Felipe, you know.
Yeah.
Did Felipe get into a Williams and find it suited him better or anything like that? I don't think so. I think it was much more the mental state.
Yeah.
And, you know, these elite sportsmen, they are, their self-esteem is really important in their performance. And I think, you know, you can, unconsciously, that self-esteem can go up and down. Once it starts to go down, it sort of spirals. And, sure. And equally, when it goes up, you know, how often have we seen a guy who struggles to win his first race, and when he's won his first race, bang, he's off, and he's winning race after race. And, and again, it's part of this, I call it self-esteem. Maybe it's more to do with confidence and things like that.
Well,
but it's definitely a human factor.
I think it's also that movement for saying, I know I can do this, I've done it. So now I really know I can do it. And it's interesting to me that somebody like, you know, a competitive guy like Nico, well, they're all competitive, I know, but as soon as he sniffs a slight, you know, the very macro chink in Lewis's armour, he's on it, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And Nigel, you mentioned Fernando, but you see, I think that's something that I've found.
Or Vettelite.
Yeah.
I would have thought winning the championship wouldn't, they would still want to win the remaining races just as much, those two.
Yeah, but I worked with Fernando for many years, and I did find, you know, the guy, it's no doubt he's a superb driver. You know, he really can find something in a car. But if there's a prospect of success, then he finds a little bit more. And he could drive much harder, more aggressively, faster for a podium position than an equal fight for sixth position. So.
Yeah, there were times in 2008 and 2009, the second time round at Renault when the car wasn't that good, where Fernando didn't stand out from any number of other
drivers. That's true.
That's right. And then in Japan, when he won there, you know, he was on it.
Yeah. Sure. But I think part of the fascination, Rob, you talk about human and not cars. For me, the fascination is that it's both and how they interact.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I don't think it's coincidence that Hamilton, as the title became a formality, as that came onto the horizon, I think what was going on at the same time was the Pirelli stipulation about the tyres and the impact that had on the Mercedes in terms of the setup that it could run. And I think Nico understood the implications of that change in setup and worked a lot harder at understanding the implications of it than Lewis did. You know, probably Lewis had other commitments.
Yeah.
You know, not just going to parties. I mean, you know, as world champion.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Probably more commitments he was penciled in for than Nico. So maybe that played its part as well, if we're being charitable. But I don't think it was purely just a driver thing, although I think it was partly that. I think there was also a technical element to it.
Can someone explain that to me then? What happened that Nico got a handle on better than Lewis did? I don't quite understand that tiny change in the tyre pressures. Pat, can you, what effect is,
well,
that?
Is it an effect at all? I think this is what I'm getting at, that, you know, Lewis believes that something changed on the car in the latter part of the year. Now, I suspect that the Mercedes engineers are scratching their head wondering about that. It is true, of course, you know, from Monza we did have to run with different tyre pressure prescriptions, and they will have altered the car, but to the point where it totally swings it, I find it hard to believe. And that's what I was alluding to earlier when I said, yeah, we all think we're clever and we think we understand these things, but I'm really not sure we always do.
But then we saw Mercedes in Singapore, where, you know, the car which had dominated for the previous 2 years was suddenly a second off the pace. It was sort of a net swing of 2 seconds, they put that down to was running in completely the wrong window for the new tyre pressures.
There will be something in that for sure.
Pat, we have a question from Eric Blaise, and Eric wants you to talk to him about your pit stops, because he suggests that Williams's pit stops are not always as good as its competitors. Would you?
Well, Eric, it's very nice you said it that politely, because they really have been appalling.
Well, actually, he didn't. I did.
Okay, well, thank you. Our pit stops this year really have been they've been a horror story. We've had a problem. Once the car's running, the wheel nuts just tighten up, and when we come into the pit stop, we're losing a really significant amount of time with the guns just hammering away trying to get these tight nuts off. Now, you'd sort of think, well, that can't be that difficult to solve. Boy, it's taken us a little while to do it. We got pretty well on top of it towards the end of the season, and our average over the last three races, which consisted, if I remember rightly, of 14 pit stops, did get us back into the top three, but still at risk, because when one of these does go tight, we'd have a totally awful pit stop again. So we have completely redesigned the hub system for next year, and in the testing the factory-based testing we've been doing, I think we've got on top of it. So I really hope we have. I don't want to be answering that question again next year.
No, I'm quite sure you don't. No. Well, thanks for the question, Eric. He described them as painfully slow, just for the record.
You're
just,
there.
Okay. Ian Bilby would like to know, Pat, do you guys in F1 get any sort of home life with so many races on the calendar these days? Do you have any interests, any activities, leisure outside Formula One anymore?
Yeah, it really is hard. You know, the season is very, very long. More and more flyaway races, which, you know, by definition take more time out of your home life, etc. I'm quite lucky. I don't go to every race because, you know, there's a lot to do at the factory, but that doesn't mean that I work any less. It just means that, don't have all the travel and stuff. And it's interesting that, you know, when I was younger and getting involved with Formula One, people actually they loved the travel side of it. You know, it was part of the attraction. These days I find it more and more difficult, you know, particularly as people get into their sort of late 30s and they have families.
It was a very different world championship back then, Pat.
It wasn't I mean, when you were away you worked a hell of a lot harder than you do now. You know, working all night was common. We don't have those sort of antisocial sides of it, but the number of races we do, amount of travelling we do, I think it becomes really hard for the guys who got young families. It's tough.
Okay. We must take some more of our questions here, because otherwise there's no point in all these guys sending them in. Santiago Upegui, I think that's right, says, is there a reason that ground effects are not a bigger topic of discussion for improving racing after 2016?
Improving racing. I mean, they're a very efficient way of getting downforce, that's for sure.
I think, if I just interrupt very quickly, I think when people talk about improving racing and they talk, and you know, you've landed on some of these generalizations quite rightly. I think the undercurrent here is people saying, you know, they want more drama, more excitement on the track.
Come and sit in my seat then. I have quite enough drama. I think that Santiago, I think actually he's asked a question before of one of our podcasts. I believe so. But I think that there's a what may well be a misconception that ground effect cars are not affected by the wake of the car in front. Yeah. I don't think there's any evidence that that's the case. And the little bit of work that's been done on this, and I'm going back now to the overtaking working group of 2008 that I was a member of, perhaps showed the opposite. Now, I won't say it was the best bit of science I've ever done in my life, but the work that we did suggest that actually any downforce that was generated by the body was actually more affected by the wake of the car in front. So I think it's a bit of a misconception that ground effect is the answer to everything in terms of better racing. For sure, it gives you much more efficient aerodynamics, no doubt about it. Lift to drag ratios are way beyond anything you can do with wings, but not necessarily something that I think will lead to better racing.
Okay. Well, don't bother asking that for a third time, Santiago, because...
No, it was a different question last time, I'm sure. Maybe it's a different person.
Okay, guys, can I... Pat?
I'm interested you say that, Pat, because what sundry drivers have said over time is that when they're following a car in the ground effect era, it was less disturbed than an era when all the downforce is coming from wings.
I don't know that there's any driver who'd know that.
I guess. They just sort of felt that the car was following
in
a ground effect era has washed out less than it does now.
So the only people who may know that are drivers who drove in 83, we moved away from ground effect. But, boy, we have primitive aerodynamics then. Really primitive.
Yeah, that's true.
They're so much more sophisticated now. You know, in 83, and I remember it well, the Tolman... the 83 Tolman was an incredibly quick car. First flat bottom car, fastest at Rio in testing, etc., etc. But gosh, it was unsophisticated. There were vortices all over the world coming from that thing, you know. Whereas now we try and control them a little
swirly. Okay, here's a fastball for you. Ray Tanvir says, do you think Williams could have won a Grand Prix or two over the last two seasons if you had a top driver?
Okay, right.
I think
I'm going to answer the question, but first I would say that, you know, I'm immensely proud of what we've done at Williams. It's been one of the highlights of my career, you know, that being involved with getting that team up to third place twice in a row, because doing it for a second time, I think, shows that there's no luck in it. You know, it's good, solid quality. Sure. So I'm immensely proud of that. And I have to say I've enjoyed it as much as winning the World Championships that I've been involved with. But in doing it, I have this overriding regret that we haven't won a race in the last 2 years. And, it really gets at me. The first answer to the question is, whoa, I wish we had won the race. But I do think that given the opportunities, and I mean by that the car, the team, the operation, the whole thing, I don't see why our guy shouldn't win a race. You know, Felipe has won races. He knows how to win races. Valtteri will win races, believe me. So I don't think that it's that has stopped us. You know, a few points more downforce, a few kilowatts of engine power, and quicker pit stops, and we'll get there.
Yeah. Pat, do you think that maybe less on the driver and more on perhaps strategy at Silverstone this year? I mean, there are times in the past when one team with its two cars running at the front might have imposed on driver. I mean, say Valtteri notionally being quicker, said to Felipe, right, your job, you're the jammer car, let Valtteri go, we're going to try and get into it. I mean, do you think that race was winnable if you'd employed that kind of selfish strategy or sacrificing one driver for the sake of the other?
No, I don't.
No.
You know, Silverstone's been analysed to hell by the whole world and twice as much by everyone at Grove. So, firstly... It is our philosophy, and it always will be our philosophy. We're going to let the guys race.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Secondly, particularly at that stage of the season, what it's all about is Constructors' Championship. You know, we're not a rich team. We need to earn that money. We need to protect our position, because you could ask the same question. In fact, I believe we did talk about this before with Austria in 2014, and I explained then that Alonso got so close to us in that race that if we had done anything brave, we'd have lost a position. There's no doubt about it. At Silverstone, slightly different situation, and of course we're only talking about the first part of the race before the rain started, where Valtteri is sort of saying, well, look, I'm quicker than him, let me pass. Well, A, that's not the way we operate, and B, what evidence do you have? Every driver who's following another driver thinks they're quicker than them, because they don't have the concept of distance, speed and time. What they do is they close up on the brakes and they say, oh, I haven't got such good traction, and you know, they just say, I'm quicker, I know I can go quicker, it's easy. It's not quite like that. Equally, if we had tried to swap them over with the Mercedes were right on our exhaust pipes, I'm quite sure if we tried to do something a bit too clever, we had a chance of losing position to them. So I don't think it was that. You know, we, let's face it, we got into that position because Mercedes made poor starts. They still had a quicker car than us. They qualified in front of us. They were lapping quicker than us in the dry part of the race. They had a quicker car, and you know, that's a pretty good way to win races, to have a quick car. That's yes. That's what we all try and do. Of course, ultimately we got the rain, and that absolutely destroyed our race anyway. But I do think I don't know all the answers. I say we've analyzed it over and over again. We have, but one never knows until it's actually happened. But my belief is that it wouldn't have made any difference to the outcome of the first part of the race, forgetting about what happened once the rain started.
I remember a few races back when you were running Fernando in the Michelin days against Ross and the Bridgestone Ferrari, and they would run I seem to recall the Bridgestones were quite delicate on full tanks. You couldn't hammer them on full tanks, and they would use Rubens to keep Fernando off Michael's back while Michael got the tyres into good shape and then sprinted off. That's something that you wouldn't sort of envisage doing.
That we certainly used to race like that when we had in those days you're talking of, in the Renault days, it was a little bit of a sort of a one-car team, as Ferrari was, and I think both of us were just racing one car against another car. We would use those sort of tactics for sure. At Williams, we don't race like that. I'm not saying we never will, but at the moment, our rules of engagement, and we have written rules of engagement, so you know, we don't have these sort of discussions and arguments afterwards. So beginning of every season, I write the rules of engagement that everyone signs up to, and that's how we go racing. And at the moment, those are that we will race each other as hard as we'll race anyone else.
I'd like to ask you a question about Frank Williams, actually, because so many fans around the world love the Williams team, and a big reason for that is Frank, in my opinion. What an amazing man. Give us some sort of insight into, he comes to quite a few races, doesn't he? And how involved does he get, Pat?
Frank is a fabulous person. Frank is at the factory at Grove every single day of the week. You can go to his office anytime you want, always got time for you. In fact, always welcomes you, because he just loves chatting about racing.
What, like, when are we going to win?
Yeah, he does ask me that occasionally. But yeah, Frank doesn't take that sort of final executive role. Of course not. You know, these days. But he still has a sort of strategic role. You know, he still he knows where he wants the team to go. He knows what he wants the business to do, and he communicates that. And that is essentially what we work to. And everyone at Grove has this. They're in awe of Frank. You know, and what he's done. And everyone works for Frank. You know, it's just so nice that you know, the name above the door is the guy sitting in the office in the top corner. You know, that means something. Yeah.
So many people, when Enzo was alive, used to say at the back of their heads, there was always the thought, essentially, you know, I'm racing for Enzo. In my experience, I would say Frank is probably the only other person of whom that could be said.
Yeah, I
remember Clay talking about it, for instance, back in 1979.
I think you're right. And you know, a lot of people in Formula One are quite transient. Frank's anything but transient, isn't he? He's been there forever, and people respect that. And at his heart is motor racing. There's nothing else matters. You know, we have a very successful advanced engineering division at Grove that do some fabulous projects. But yeah, Frank's interested in them as a business. But but really, how much money can they generate to pay for the Formula One team? It's racing is in his heart.
Well, you're going to be very involved in the Jaguar Formula E car, aren't you, at Grove? This is the latest development.
Yeah, absolutely. Williams Advanced Engineering are really world leaders in a lot of the electric vehicle technology. As I'm sure a lot of people know, they supply all the batteries to Formula E. They've done electric vehicles for, you know, people as prestigious as Aston Martin and the electric Evoque and things like that. But with the Jaguar Formula E project, which is being done in advanced engineering, it goes a bit further because they'll be doing the whole powertrain for that car and indeed racing it as well.
Yeah. Okay. You said you had something on your telephone that you wanted to share with us.
I was going to do it if the opportunity came up.
Well, the opportunity is here, right?
Is it the Concorde Agreement? I haven't seen the Concorde Agreement yet.
Some of my bedtime reading, of course, is the rules and regulations of Formula One. And the other day, I happened to come across this, which is
in the statutes of
the FIA. And it amused me because it says potential candidates to stand for election to the position of president, deputy presidents, vice presidents, presidents, members of the Senate, members of the World Councils, and members of the Ethics Committee must be under 75 years of age on the day of the election or of re-election. I just found that amusing. I don't know why.
I think it's very indicative of a certain kind of bureaucracy, isn't it?
It didn't say anything about age limits for commercial rights holders anywhere.
Of course not.
While we're on the subject of age, can we talk about some of the young drivers of 2015, because I think they've been Mark might agree with me, they've been a talking point, certainly been exciting to watch. Who's impressed you, Pat?
Well, the obvious answer is Max Verstappen. I think he's impressed everyone, but I have to say Carlos Sainz as well. Funny thing with Carlos Sainz, because his dad is one of my heroes. Yeah, I think rally drivers are just out of this world. And I was really quite thrilled, probably about this time last year, maybe a little bit earlier, when, I don't know what the plural of Carlos is it Carly, came to see us, senior and junior, to see what prospects there were at Williams. And firstly, I thought that Carlos Jr. was just a really nice guy, you know, really down to earth, very well brought up. You know, everything about him was good. And I've almost felt a little bit sorry for him this year because I think he's been overshadowed. I actually think there's a hell of a lot of quality there, but Max is definitely something special and taking the focus away a little bit.
But you say that, but I mean, look at Sainz's opening lap at in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah.
Jesus, you know,
yes,
I mean,
absolutely.
Gilles would have been proud of that.
I really think the guy is good.
And first time at Suzuka, it was wet, and most people just crash in those circumstances as novices. He went P1, second faster than Verstappen.
Yeah, no, there's some quality there, and I think the focus has been on Max. But I think we shouldn't forget Carlos is pretty good.
Well, it's interesting, actually, if they had both been 20. perhaps it would have been a little more, you know, even-handed in terms of the sort of hoopla and publicity and whatnot.
You mean over
they,
the hill?
They had.
yes. God, there's no future for us like that, I tell you. Anyway.
I think the other one, it's just one of the things that I really enjoyed, yeah, one of the high points of the year was to see Sauber and Felipe Nasser in Australia. You know, Sauber had that terrible dry period in 2014. I was so pleased to see them get points in Australia. Felipe, of course, I've been Williams test driver the year before. I think he's a really nice guy as well, and I was so pleased to see the points come there. It was a fabulous start for him. It faded after that a little bit, unfortunately. But
is that money?
I honestly don't know. But
he had a terrific race in Russia, actually. But I think he had a little. They teamed him up with a rookie engineer as well, so I think there's a certain extent that they got lost, they got sidetracked, and then they came back again. But I think when everything's working well for Felipe, I think he's terrific, and I think there's a lot of quality there. It's not obvious because of the results and the level of the car, but I think the peaks are more indicative of his potential than the average, let's say.
Talking of young drivers, Williams has got Alex Lynn, young Brit, on its books. What have you seen of him so far?
Yeah, he's had a bit of a mixed season in GP2. Some good results, a few mistakes. There's nothing wrong with a young driver making mistakes. That's how you learn. GP2's a strange formula. You know, it's very difficult to impress in the first year. Second year is the one that counts, and of course, so often, not this year, but so often, the winners have sort of come in their third or even more years in GP2. So I think Alex, I would class that as a good first year in GP2, but next year is probably the one that counts.
Okay, can we just very briefly look ahead? Because it's not long. I know. Pat looks tired already. Anyway, but next year, what can we expect, you guys, all of you guys? Can we expect McLaren to be up at the front? How do you think next year's going to go, Pat?
Yeah, when you asked me down here today for the preview, I thought to myself, for the review of 2015, I thought, well, I'd much rather do that than the preview, because all you do is make an arse of yourself, don't
yes,
you?
Yes, I know. Yes, I know, but I specialise in that.
So, what are we going to see next year? I don't know. I think that quite a few of the things that happened this year were not expected. I think Ferrari's resurgence this year, of course I expected them to come back, but it was stronger than I thought. I was very surprised at Red Bull falling away the way they did. I didn't think that McLaren Honda was going to be that strong, but they were much weaker than I thought. So, you know, my record of predicting future Formula One seasons is about the same as my predicting of lottery numbers. I'm not very good at it, to be honest. But honestly, We are going to see Ferrari get closer. I'm sure of that. I really hope, and I'm really pushing to get Williams closer. Yeah. But it's a long way to go. You know, over the year, on average, in qualifying and racing, Williams to Mercedes has been about 0.94 of a percent in racing, that we've been off their pace, and just over 1% in qualifying. That's a lot to close up. We've got to work hard at it.
How much do you think it would be if you had the same engines?
I think the engine that the works cars had from Monza onwards was quite a nice little step for them, as indeed the Ferrari was. They're stopwatch measurable.
Okay, can we go around the table, just our highlights and low points of another Grand Prix season? And I mean, Mark, we must start with you because you're there every one.
Yeah, for me, it was actually just as in 2014, it was Hungarian Grand Prix. Remarkably similar, those two races, the Hungarian at 14 and 15, the way that it panned out, and you had four cars in the closing stages, all in contention for victory, just an absolute thriller of a race on both occasions. That was the best race. Probably the most thrilling manoeuvre, I think, was Max Verstappen going around the outside of Felipe Nasr and Blanchimont at 190 miles an hour. That was pretty thrilling.
You still wonder if that was deliberate, don't you? When you see it time and time again.
Yeah, well, he committed, so he might as well go through with it.
Is that something you'd do by mistake? Anyway, Simon, cast your mind back over the year. Good points, bad points.
I was pleased to see Sebastian Vettel do as well as he did at Ferrari, because I've always rated him as being far more than a one-trick pony that can drive, you know, Adrian Newey trick downforce cars. We saw that in his Toro Rosso days, and to see him just kind of getting his mojo back, pretty much. I mean, he was on the podium more often than not. Had his three wins. That for me was just on a personal level was very gratifying. The Hungarian Grand Prix I only saw in highlights because I was watching a classic motorbike festival at Cadwell Park that day.
Of course you were,
yeah. Obviously.
Surprised you weren't at
Mallory
Park testing.
I wish I had been.
that was the Wednesday afterwards. I think for me, obviously we've talked about Max a lot, and the thing that I liked about Max is not just the fact he pulls off the passing manoeuvres from half a mile back, but he does it with such control. I mean, there are no locked brakes. He's not squirreling sideways, nearly forcing the other guy off the track. It's hard, but it's clean, and I think that has been fantastically impressive.
Mr. Robert,
I think for me it was Singapore. I mean, it's a terrible racetrack in terms of racing. It's not much better than Monaco, in fairness.
It's got a good zoo in Singapore. That's good. Yes. If that helps.
And it's as much an endurance test as a race in many ways. But he just delighted me there to see Mercedes flat beaten. Not because of circumstance, not because this went wrong or that happened or, you know, there was a problem with some strategic mistake or whatever. They were just flat beaten. And I think after the 2 years we've had, I mean, it was just a delight to see that could still happen. The way Vettel won it reminded you of the way he won it in a Red Bull with...
It was very
blown diffuser and everything else, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I guess a high point was Vettel winning race two, and that sort of hope that we were going to get a really a really tight season. And arguably the low point was Vettel winning race two and not race three and race four, etc. But the other low point to me, a bit of a personal one, and I will take my Williams hat off, but I was very sorry to see John Booth and Graham Loudon leaving Formula One. They're two guys I've worked with, I have massive respect for. I think they're the real racers that I think Formula One needs. They're not the sort of corporate bodies. They're just people who just like to go racing and, you know, survived against all the odds. And I will certainly miss them in the paddock next year.
Pat, seeing as you are the chief egghead of all the Grove eggheads, I think it would be great for motorsport readers and listeners for you to tell us as much as you can about your new car for 2016. The reason I want to hear this is because it'd be nice when we see it roll onto the grid in Melbourne in a few weeks' time. We'll have a little sneak preview. So, I mean, Ferrari and Mercedes are not listening. I happen to know that.
So what's its lift to drag numbers?
Okay, well...
In the wheelbase?
That's what I meant, Mark. Exactly what I meant when I asked the question.
I mean, to start off, it's white.
It's
got red stripes and light blue and dark blue stripes
on it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very nice car.
Come on, Pat. I mean, what's happening with the car new for 2016?
I mean,
we're only having a chat in the pub, Pat.
You know, this is the last year of the sort of current regulations. Even if we don't know exactly where 2017 is going, we're pretty sure it's not an evolution of 2016. So the 2016 car, the last of that generation, we're not going to go too wild with things. There are little trends that have come along. In our case, you know, we've probably done quite a lot of work around the rear aerodynamics of the car. We've shortened the nose again. You know, that's no big secret. You'll see that eventually. You know, that makes it pretty difficult getting it through the crash test. But you know, that's where the challenges lie.
New hubs.
New hubs, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, don't have another question about my pit stops next year, do I? And I think, as I said earlier, you know, you're not going to look at it and say, "Wow, you know, that's different." But it's a good, solid evolution of what we've done through the last 2 years. And you know, our development rate over the last 2 years has been pretty reasonable, I think.
Yeah. Can I just? We went round the table before with the highs and lows, mostly. Taking a slight sideways glance, I think it would be appropriate to pay respect to Jules Bianchi as well, the first Formula One driver to die as a result of injuries at a racetrack for 20 odd years. He was a good kid. He was a good kid with a lot of potential, and he will be missed.
The other side of the sport that we all love, absolutely. And yeah. Okay, well, that's about it, really, for our look back on the 2015 Formula One season, unless any of you are absolutely gagging to say something else. I'd really like to thank you for coming in, Pat, and spending an hour with us in the Chelsea Ram. I know you're a busy man, and you've got a lot on your mind, a lot on your phone, a lot on your laptop. It's all happening, I know that. So thank you very, very much, and I hope you'll have some time to come and see us next year.
Yeah, of course, it's always a pleasure to do it. And I hope we just, you know, get a few things across to the fans of what F1's about, because it is a complicated sport, and I enjoy trying to explain it to people.
Yeah, well, it needs simplifying.
Absolutely.
Especially for me. because it's Christmas, don't sigh, Mark. Because it's Christmas, I just want to go around the team. And Pat Simmons, what would be the best thing Santa could bring you in the next few days?
30 points of downforce.
30 points of downforce. Okay. Yep. How exciting.
It's been top of my Christmas list for a few years now.
Okay, well, let's hope he can get that into your stocking. Mr. Hughes.
I'd like them to rip the regs up and start again.
Oh, me too, absolutely. Yeah. Mr. Aaron.
I concur with Mark, and I'd like just have a single sheet of A4 saying minimum weight, maximum width, height, you know, length, full stop, do anything else you like within a control
maximum
budget.
Budget, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, maximum budget and safety. That's a part. I'd like a nice big lens that actually reaches over some of the Formula One runoff areas, because trying to take photographs of Formula One circuits, some Formula One circuits nowadays, you need to spend about $10,000 on a lens, which is, you know, I can't afford.
Okay.
Or we could just have all the rounds at Monaco or something.
What about your stocking, Mr. Roebuck?
Jesus, all the rounds at Monaco.
For photographic purposes.
No, I was going to guess. Yeah, all right. I was going to say.
Don't make it complicated.
All my nightmares coming at once.
I like them all in Melbourne.
I completely agree with what the boys have said. I think for next year, really, the main thing is I would like to see every top driver with the equipment to be in the thick of it.
You're talking about Fernando Alonso.
I'm talking about Jenson Button as well. I'm talking, and not just those two.
Okay.
I mean, I think Lewis has had it very easy for the last couple of years.
Okay. Well, when Santa comes to me, which he always does, in a few days' time, I want 31 points of downforce for my team, and I want fewer penalties, fewer regulations, and more noise. Okay. Thank you very much,
you
everybody.
You don't want Formula E, then?
What about driverless cars?
Oh, no.
Yeah, well, it was the next logical step. Wasn't
there
it?
Is one person, I think, who would love a driverless car, and that's Frank.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good way of reducing the budget, isn't it? But you will have a little bit more noise next year. You know, the changes to the wastegate, there's a little bit there. It's not huge, but there's a little bit.
Good. Okay.
Well, I don't want them to sound like the V8s anyway. I just thought that really was white racket. They all sounded exactly the same. And and they all had no horsepower.
Okay. Well, we all love motor racing. We all do various jobs within motor racing, and we all want great racing, don't we? Simple as that, isn't it? We just want great racing. Okay. Thank you very much, Pat Simmons, Mark Hughes, Simon Aaron, Nigel Robrack, Ed Foster, our web editor, who puts all this together for us, types out all the scripts, the questions, nice big print for me because I can't see properly, and to Alan Hyde, who records it all for us, goes home, edits it, never makes any mistakes. Fantastic. You want him on your team. Goodbye, everybody. Have a great Christmas. See you in 2016, and thanks so much for all your support. And enjoy the next Motorsport magazine. Goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.